Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to the New Books in African Studies podcast. I am your host, Ari Barbalat. Today, it is my blessing to be in dialogue with Martin Koutenier. He is presently visiting professor of history at the University of Ghent. He is a historian and an anthropologist based at the history section of the Royal Museum of Central Africa in Tervuren, Belgium. He specializes in the history of colonial museums, the history of science, and in the history of Belgian colonization in general. We will be discussing his newly published book, Anthropology and Race in Belgium and Congo, 1839 to 1922, published by Routledge Publishers, 2024. Martin, it's an honor to be with you today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
To begin, please tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up? What formative events in your life inspired the scholar you would become as an adult?
Yes, my name is Martin Koutenier. I'm a historian and an anthropologist, and so I've studied mainly at Leuven University, where I first did history and then later on moved to anthropology. And I think that my focus or my interest in Africa was already present when I studied history. And that was my interest and increased during my training as an anthropologist. And then I did a study on the history of the museum, and that later evolved into my PhD, which was already concerned with the history of sciences.
What inspired you to write this book? What message do you hope to convey to readers?
I think the main message is about the history of physical anthropology and how people started to think in terms of races. And the aim really is to deconstruct that epistemology and try to show how this debate about races is still influencing debate about racism today. And so the final goal is to deconstruct that whole idea that people can be separated on the basis of physical characters like skin color.
What are the primary themes in your books? What story does your book tell?
So the book is primarily concerned with the history of physical anthropology, but I also try to look at it in a broad way. And I've discussed the history of several sciences at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And the book now also includes the history of archaeology, history, and linguistics, for example. And I show how physical anthropologists were in disagreement with historians and linguists and archaeologists, because in their mind, they offered no solution to the question of where races originated and how they spread all over the world. And when you look at the message that linguists and historians were writing about, then you can more easily understand why physical anthropologists were so tempted to use the word race because it was a sort of all-encompassing category that could explain everything in their mind. Of course, it explained nothing, but they thought that the notion of race would solve all the problems about anthropology. And in the end, it proved, of course, to be an empty category. But one of the advantages of studying the debate in such a broad perspective is it's been very helpful to explain why they turned towards race.
What does your research teach us about the atrocities that unfolded in the Belgian Congo?
Yes, so there's a remarkable twist in the book. In so far that colonial administrators were in fact not eager to accept the insights of physical anthropologists. So in theory, they were against the idea of race because race was something permanent and colonial administrators needed something more adaptive. So they needed the concept of a malleable African that could evolve and could be turned into a more civilized person. So they needed the notion of evolution. But the notion of evolution was very difficult in the vocabulary of physical anthropologists because they thought that races were permanent. And so these two paradigms were not easy to... were in fact in conflict with each other. So there were, on the one side, anthropologists said races are permanent and we cannot adapt to new circumstances. And colonial administrators said, yes, but we still can evolve. And they, so they relied more on the influence of the environment. But that was, of course, all in the discourse of colonial propaganda. And when you look at the terrain in Congo itself, there you see that these racist ideas were omnipresent in the structure, political structure, but also in the architecture of new cities where white and black people were physically separated, and also in the daily behavior of colonial people in Congo were very racist toward African people. And so they, in fact, dehumanized Congolese. They were almost non-human. And so that's why I think that explains why they were able to collect human remains, because they treated people as something that was part of nature. And so then they dehumanized Congolese, and it's only when you dehumanize people that you can start to collect their body parts, I think.
Can you tell us about Emile Ouzé? Why is he significant?
Yes, so the book is structured in different chapters, and it starts with Domalius Dalois. Then in the second chapter, I discuss Léon van der Kinderen. And then, sorry, in the third chapter, I discuss Emile Ouzé and Victor Jacques. And so the book is really talking about biographies. And I place the individual researchers at the center of the book because I feel that you really need to understand where these people come from, what their beliefs are, and what their political convictions are in order to understand what they are writing. And so in the case of Emile Ouzé, it's very important to understand that he was a Freemason liberal, that he was schooled in ULB as a medical doctor, and that his family originated in France. And so only after all that research, you can understand why Emile Ouzé was so much in favor of the connection with the French anthropologists, and why he worked at ULB as a Freemason, why he was in the Faculty of Medicine, why he collected body parts, and why he was convinced that people with more round skulls were more superior than people with elongated skulls. He was very much in favor of the the French example and admired Paul Broca, for example.
Can you tell us as well about Léon van der Kinderen?
Yes, so Léon van der Kinderen was also at ULB, but was a bit different person because he was in favor of a connection with the German culture. And training or his education and his family played an important role. We know, for example, that Housset was relatively small and had a round skull. We know from van der Kinderen that he had blue eyes, so pale eyes. And so we see there that physical characters of the research themselves determined their viewpoints in anthropology. So that's really remarkable. And van der Kinderen then did a lot of research on hair color and eye color, and that was very much influenced by Virchow, the German anthropologist, and he copied these research methods then in Belgium.
Can you describe the phenomenon of human zoos?
Yes, human zoos are a phenomenon that was present in Europe, but also in the United States or in the Americas and even in Africa. And it is a thing that was very present in world exhibitions where living people were exhibited in fake villages, much like animals were exhibited in the zoo. So European people came to watch African people while they were forced to perform so-called daily life in Europe. And these human zoos were also used in colonial propaganda to show that they were able to evolve. So military men from Congo, for example, asked to march and to perform musical pieces. And so people could see that they were able to adapt and to take over elements from European culture, but at the same time, that still a lot of work need to be done. So African people were always compared with big children, and Europeans were then the adults that would lead them to civilization. And that's omnipresent in colonial propaganda as well, that colonization needed another 100 or 200 years before Congolese would be able to be independent. Of course, reality was very different, and Congo already became independent in 1960.
How did W.E.B. Du Bois perceive the Belgian Congo?
Yes, what's also new in the book is that I've studied many critical voices. So I not only tried to describe the dominant voice of physical anthropologists who were always very negative about African culture, but I also incorporated the critical voice of Firmin, for example, who was a Haitian advocate, of Paul Panda Farnana, who was a Congolese who lived in Belgium. And I also devoted much attention to Du Bois, who was living in the United States. I was one of the first to write a PhD at Harvard about the history of slavery. And so I came across Du Bois because a Belgian librarian who was in the service of the Ministry of Colonies was writing very negative about Du Bois. And then I returned to his original publications, and then I found that Du Bois was very critical to colonialism in general, but especially the colonization of the Belgians. And he tried to create an independent state in Africa, where Africans would be independent. And since all the atrocities were committed by the soldiers of Leopold II, he especially was critical on the Belgian Congo and stated that he would that the Portuguese and the Belgians would lose their colonies and that that region could be used then for Africans to be more free and could have their own political and economic system. So that's why there was a lot of anxiety within colonial administration regarding Du Bois, and then later Fernana, who was who admired Du Bois. And so you see that there was a lot of publications and interference in conferences to minimize the impact of Du Bois and to come with a different voice. So CIMAR, for example, stated that Belgian anthropologists had no role in racial thinking. And so he minimized the effect of racial discourse in colonialism.
Can you say more about Paul Panda Fernana? Can you contextualize him for us?
Yes, Fernana was a Congolese, one of the few Congolese who lived in Belgium. So Belgium and Congo were in fact very much separated. So in contrast to the French colonies, Belgian colonies were really separated from the European continent. So Congolese were not allowed to travel much to Belgium. And Fernana was one of the only Congolese, the few Congolese that were present in Belgium. He lived in Brussels and served in World War I as one of the only Congolese soldiers. He was captured by the Germans and was then a prisoner of war. And after his return, he was very critical about colonialism and racism and the notion of race, which had led to the outbreak of World War I. And he then joined the Pan-African Congress in Brussels. And there he made a speech that was not welcomed by colonial administration. And you see that that colonial administration, so the Ministry of Colonies, intervened in the final manifest of the conference. So Du Bois wrote the initial manifesto in London, but when the conference moved to Brussels, the Ministry of Colonies interfered and changed the text. So all these changes are very significant of colonial administration and their impact on racial discourse and on the new voices that were emerging were more talking about emancipation and political rights for Africans in Africa.
Can you say more about Antonin Firmin and his importance in the history of the Belgian Congo?
Yes, Firmin was important in that respect that he was one of the first to criticize physical anthropology. So this is already in 1885, and Firmin had little impact on Belgian colonization, but had a huge impact on the deconstruction of racial discourse. In the first place in Paris, where he was member of the Société d'Anthropologie de Paris. So there, people from the colonies could be member of scientific societies. And he wrote a very remarkable book on the equality of races by using the methods of physical anthropology. So he used the methods of science to contradict scientific insights of physical anthropologists. And that caused a lot of panic in Paris, but also in Brussels, because the people like Houzé were very much influenced by French anthropologists. And so when Firmin said that the ideals of the French Revolution, fraternity, equality, were not realized yet, that really provoked Houzé to react against Firmin in the Société d'Anthropologie de Brussels. So Houzé was very much against equality of human races and really tried until the end of his life to separate different races.
Can you tell us about the Congo Museum?
Yes, so the book in the first three chapters is really dealing with the Société d'Anthropologie de Brussels. And then in the fourth chapter, this is around 1900, the museum in Tervuren, so the Congo Museum, now the Africa Museum, plays an important role. So the museum was created in 1898, was a museum, but also a scientific institute. And one of the scientific sections was devoted to archaeology and anthropology. and Victor Jacques, who was the Secretary General of the Société d'Anthropologie de Bruxelles, also became the head of the anthropology section interviewing. And so the museum started to collect human remains from Congo, and these then were analyzed by Victor Jacques.
How does your study shed light on the origins of Aryanism as a racial theory?
Aryanism was hugely important in the long 19th century. So many people believed that humankind had originated in Asia, especially in the Himalayas, where the Aryans lived, and that the Aryans had spread all over the world to spread culture, language, metalwork, agriculture. So this idea was hugely influential, especially among linguists and historians, but also among anthropologists. And anthropologists, in fact, especially in Belgium, reacted against the idea of Aryanism. So they said that Houzé, for example, was a polygynist. He said that the different races had originated in different places. So it's a more crude form of racism that was very much present in the anthropological society in Brussels.
What misconceptions about the Belgian Congo does your study attempt to correct? Why do these misconceptions exist and persist?
Yes, one of the misconceptions is that anthropology helped to create races, or the idea of races in Congo, and that politics used anthropology to gain knowledge about Congolese populations. But as far as I've found, is that anthropology did not help politics. Quite the contrary, and that the discourse within anthropology was in fact incompatible with the discourse within colonial administration. And so when the museum interviewing is created and the ethnography room is installed, this is not done by anthropologists. This is done by former military men, and the division is very much a geographical separation between regions and not based on anthropological fieldwork or anthropological studies of physical anthropology. And this is really a political grid that is installed on the colony without consultation of anthropologists.
How is the field of anthropology impacted by trends in the field of linguistics during the time you focus on in your book?
Yes, there was a very much a disagreement between linguists and anthropologists. So linguists were in most cases monogenists, so they thought that humankind was one, and stated that people originated in the Himalayas and then descended towards Europe. That claim was made on the basis of similarities between a Sanskrit and European languages. But according to anthropologists, this was not a valuable argument to state that, or to study the migration of races. So they separated the biological component from the linguistic component. Since linguists were very often in dispute about who moved where and in what time, anthropologists were proposing to use more the concept of race and biology and anatomy to come up with more fixed or more objective solutions in their mind. Of course, these solutions were then far from objective, but in their idea, that was something to study more instead of language and history.
Who was Arsène Maton?
Yes, so in the final chapters of the book, I devote more attention to Arsène Maton and the process of plastocast. So in the beginning of physical anthropology in Belgium, you see that there was a lot of study of skin color, of hair color, eye color, and then later on, the measurements of skulls. And then only later on, new methods were applied, like photography and plaster casting. And Arsène Maton was an artist from Brussels who moved to Congo, visited Congo in 1911 and made plaster casts of living Congolese in Kinshasa. And then later on, he turned the casts into 3D sculptures of busts and torsos of Congolese people. So he participated in the idea that physical characters could be used to determine races. And his presence in Congo was far from artistic, let's say. So his presence provoked a lot of disputes and a lot of anger, because people were forced to participate in the project. People thought that they would die when the plaster was applied. He also used a lot of sex workers that were in service of colonial administrators. And so a lot of problems were generated by this process. And when he returned, the overall outcome of the project was then questioned by the director of the Tervuren Museum. So Arsène Maton was a Freemason, and the director at that time, who had to make an exhibition with these plaster casts, was Catholic. So he refused to let these plaster casts enter his museum. And then the Ministry of Colonies interfered, and then a short-lived exhibition was organized and almost immediately removed from the museum.
What does your research reveal about the history of Freemasonry?
Yes, in earlier publications, I was a bit reluctant to discuss the role of Freemasonry, but it's become clear that the ULB in Brussels and Freemasonry played an important role in physical anthropology, and especially at ULB and at the Société d'Anthropologie de Bruxelles. And so you see that Freemasons were more polygonists and had a more crude form of racism that was not accepted at Catholic universities, for example.
What new perspectives are presented here regarding the evolution and diffusion of Darwinist thought?
Yes, the Darwinism is appearing in the later chapters of the book. So, as I explained before, physical anthropologists had great difficulty with the concept of evolution because they thought that races were permanent. They all already accepted the concept of evolution in the as Lamarck created it, but Darwinism was going a step further, and they were not willing to accept Darwinism at first. And so it was only when an archaeologist, Edouard Dupont, urged anthropology to enter the way of Darwinism that these ideas about evolution were slowly accepted by Jacques, but Housset was not willing to adopt Darwinism.
How does your study shed new light on the roles of Catholicism in the Belgian Congo?
What I found out in this book is that Catholicism played an important role in physical anthropology as much as Freemasonry did. One of the first Belgian anthropologists, for example, was Domalius Dalois. He was a Catholic. Simard, who was the librarian of the Ministry of Colonies, was also a Catholic. Alphonse de Holleville, the first director of the Tervuren Museum, was also Catholic. And that religious belief influenced their insights very much. Domalius Dalois is a special case because he's moving in between monogamism and polygamism. So of course, the Bible says that human species is one. So you have Adam and Eve in the beginning. But he's reluctant to accept that the environment plays an important role, for example, an argument that was always made by Monoganists. So he, one by one, he eliminates all the arguments of Monoganists, and then he slowly moves more to polygonism. He was also a friend of Paul Broca, who was a polygonist, but in the end he's undecided. So it's a kind of a special person in the history of anthropology.
Who was Victor Jacques? Can you tell us about his importance?
Victor Jacques was a Freemason medical anthropologist, and he was in fact the driving force behind the Société d'Anthropologie de Bruxelles, the Anthropological Society in Brussels. So he was the secretary general. So, and it's often not seen as such, but the secretary general is the head of the society. And so the president changes all the time, but secretary general stays in function all the time. And so in Paris, that was Paul Broca, and in Brussels, that was Victor Jacques. And so he led the Anthropological Society in Brussels between 1882 until 1911. So that's quite a long time that he was in charge of this society. He also published the journal of the society. So his role is really, really important.
In what ways is the story you tell in this book regarding anthropology and race in the Belgian Congo unique to the Belgian Congo? What similarities, if any, exist in the history of other African colonies? What similarities, if any, exist in the history of other colonies in Southeast Asia, the Caribbean, South Asia, or other parts of the world?
Yes, so what I try to show is that you really need to study history of anthropology within its context. So you cannot use ideas or concepts that are used in the history of physical anthropology in Great Britain or France. You can't move that without any problems to the Belgian context. Belgian context is very specific. Belgium has its own history. There's the disputes between the Flemish and the Walloons that heavily influenced anthropological debates here in Belgium. And so you really need to dig into the biographies of the anthropologists to understand what they were talking about. In the case of Dumilius Delbar, for example, it's really important to see that he was still in favor of the union between the Netherlands and Belgium. These two countries were united between 1815 and 1830, and he was, in fact, a politician in that system. He was the governor of Namur. And it's really important to see that he was an Orangist, and that this opinion or this political conviction influenced his work dramatically. So, for example, he used the image of Abdelkader as a representation of the white race. But this image is, of course, not chosen by hazard. So it was an attack on the French. Abdelkader was one of the military leaders in Algeria who defeated the French. So these are things that you can only understand when you see that Dumilius Delbar was Orangist and anti-French, and that these ideas influenced this anthropological work.
What challenges, if any, did you encounter in working with your sources in preparing this research? What difficulties did you face? How did you overcome them?
Yes, one of the biggest challenges was the vast amount of publications and journals that were available. So especially the period before the creation of the Anthropological Society in Brussels, you see that the sources are very much dispersed in Paris, in the Société d'Anthropologie, but also in the academy that was created here in Belgium. And so it took me, and some anthropological arguments were also made in books that look like history books. And so it's really sometimes really difficult to see where what books to read and where to go. Anthropologists also wrote many journal articles and many books, historians as well, linguists as well. So there was a vast amount, thousands and thousands and thousands of pages that I went through to come to this book. So that was the main challenge. And I think that the Corona period was really helpful, because then we were a bit isolated, and so there was much time to read or to go through all these publications.
As we bring today's dialogue to a close, can you tell us about your subsequent work? Can you tell us about any forthcoming projects or what you intend to study next?
Yes, after I've studied now the history of physical anthropology, this is a bit of a difficult subject. It's not the most positive message or the most positive publications that you can read. So I will turn my attention now to more. No, I will repeat. I'm sorry. So after the completion of this book, I will devote my attention to teaching. So I'm visiting professor now at University of Ghent, and I will also try to work more on temporary exhibitions in the Tervuren Museum.
Amazing. That's so important. I wish you the very best on those forthcoming initiatives, and thank you wholeheartedly for all the effort and sacrifice you invested in this remarkable study.
Okay, thank you.
As we end today, I am your host, Ari Barbalat, signing off on the New Books in African Studies podcast. Today, I've been in dialogue with Dr. Martin Koutenier. He is visiting professor of history at the University of Ghent. He is also a historian and an anthropologist based at the history section of the Royal Museum of Central Africa in Tervuren, Belgium. He specializes in the history of colonial museums, the history of science, and the history of Belgian colonization in general. We have been discussing his newly published book, Anthropology and Race in Belgium and Congo, 1839 to 1922, published by Routledge, 2024. Thank you wholeheartedly.
Thank you for the interview.